It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
I love your glasses and your icon that flashed right before this. The big like rock star glasses. I love those. Yeah.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Ora, hey, Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, and welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks, as always, for making your way here, checking out the episode of the series. Of course, you know what to do. If you like what you see, what you hear, hit that subscribe button. You get three new interviews every single week, a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover the new ones at all the usual spots, including Spotify, Apple Podcast, at NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Some of my recent guests include Jewel Taylor, the director and one of the screenwriters behind the Netflix film They Clone Tyrone. We had artist Madison Beer on here, Matthias Schweighofer and Tom Harper to talk about the movie Heart of Stone with Gal Gadot. Fozia, Bethany Cosentino of Best Coast, Emily Kinney from The Walking Dead, the cast of Minx, including Elizabeth Perkins. We had Ellie Kemper from The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Dylan Arnold on to talk about Oppenheimer, Keanu Reeves dropped by with his band Dogstar. We also talked with Bruno Major, Janelle Monáe, Greta Van Fleet, Ian Hunter, Lucinda Williams, and Nick Hexum from 311. Those are just some of the recent episodes that you get when you subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And that's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest is director and screenwriter Corey Finley. We're going to be talking about the movie called Landscape with Invisible Hand. Now, this is, let's see, it's a movie that it finds an occupying alien species, bureaucratic rule, and advanced technology that leaves most of Earth impoverished and unemployed, while two teenagers hatch a risky plan to ensure their family's future. So Corey's going to talk about why he chose to adapt the M.T. Anderson book, the sci-fi movies of the 80s and indie cinema of the 90s that influenced him, and casting the movie with Tiffany Haddish, Kylie Rogers, Asante Black, and Josh Hamilton, just to name a few. Corey's also going to dig into why the aliens are obsessed with 1950s American television, how his own look at the future of AI is more on the darker side. And we'll also talk a little bit about the music in the film and the Michael Abel score that soundtracks it as well. All that and more as we talk about Landscape with Invisible Hand. It's Kyle Meredith with Corey Finley.
How are you?
Landscape with Invisible Hand. What a cool, unique movie. I was thinking, and maybe you'd even said it before, but it's not only do you got this great story, but it feels like a big movie and a little movie all at the same time.
Good. Oh, good. I'm glad you said that. The heart of a little movie in the body of the sort of mecha robot of a small movie piloting a big movie.
Right. Right. And it does. It feels like that all the way through. And then we start going back to the beginning, because so what we've got here, you know, is sort of a futuristic movie in some sense. In some sense, it still feels like close enough to the present. There are aliens involved. It comes from a book from M.T. Anderson. Why was this the story that spoke to you? How did it start from the book to you to the movie?
So I just love so many things about the book. I love this kind of central metaphor that it has, where it's an alien invasion story of a young man coming of age, falling in love in a alien invaded world. But the big twist being that it's not like a military forceful invasion. It's a peaceful invasion by means of the free market, where the aliens come and they just make stuff better than we do. And we gradually accept their rulership as a matter of free market, you know, reality. I thought that was really subversive and unique, and some, you know, in a crowded world of sci-fi allegories, that's one I hadn't heard before. And I also loved how kind of just out there it was tonally, how different it was from anything I'd done before. It was not this, all respect to Black Mirror, which I love, it was not this sort of near future, 5 minutes into the future Black Mirror sort of thing. It was, it had aliens. It was going for it. And that was an appealing challenge to me, having mostly done very kind of human scale stories up to this point.
It does land at an interesting time. I mean, it was just this morning, of course, that I was reading about Tom DeLonge and Blink-182 and all the trials going, not trials, all the conversations going on in Congress about the UFOs. And I thought, something, I don't know, something's in the air, you know, no pun intended, but there seems to be sort of this, we've done it in the past, where we're starting to look upwards again, you know, we're in the 50s, the 80s, and here it is again. What is it for you? What is it for you that made you go, that's it, that's where I'm focused?
Well, I should say MGM actually did pay the US military to like declassify those videos and like make a thing. So this was our viral marketing campaign that's finally paid off. That's
well played.
Obviously not true, but yeah, there is something in the air. And I think there's in a way that's really taken off since we made the movie, there's a huge thing about AI. And I think that was not the central metaphor I was attempting to take on, but I think it speaks to some of the same ideas for sure.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, that stuff just kind of lands in your lap though, right? You know, you're like, do you feel like it's a gift?
It is a gift. I think hopefully anytime you're dealing with, you know, themes that feel relevant. And this, for me, the hook this time was really this sort of, you know, the overused term, but the late capitalism ideas and the sort of colonialism metaphors. But anytime you're dealing with that stuff, hopefully just things will happen, you know, that hopefully will kind of, if you could be agile enough and subtle enough, but also specific enough in your choice of allegories, you will, you know, grab on to new cultural developments as they arise. So that's the hope.
So, and for you and your background, you were even saying like, this is, you know, you hadn't done anything like this before, but, you know, it's almost asking a question like I'm about to ask is like musically speaking, like, oh, do you like rock music or something like that? But when we're talking about sci-fi, you know, and stepping into this, I mean, what was your come up in? No, that's a different phrase. What was your youth about like with sci-fi? I mean, were you looking at any of, you know, your favorites, the influences, anything like that?
I definitely was a kid who loved, I wasn't specifically a science fiction addict or anything like that, but I mean, I loved like E.T. and Star Wars and all that, like anyone else of my generation or any generation. And I was actually a big fantasy head. I did a lot of reading of long fantasy novels and some sci-fi too. But I love that. I think I also had, I have a real love for, I guess, kind of 90s, early 2000s, sort of a certain kind of American indie cinema that I like, being John Malkovich and these kind of very off the wall. I guess they're not science fiction so much. They're like surrealist or absurdist films. And that was a, that was something about the book that really spoke to me. Again, it has these aliens, but it does not treat them with the reverence and the seriousness that some books and movies treat their aliens. They were very much a kind of strange, deadpan, comic, surreal element. So I think it united those two interests for me.
Yeah, I mean, seeing the alien get picked up and thrown around, Like, it's not something I expected to see in the movie when you get to those moments.
You don't see that every day. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was even thinking about, like, you know, we talked about the '80s and there was movies like The Explorers, you know, Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix, you know, the kids, there are those moments that sort of, I don't know. It doesn't remind me of that because I really do love the surrealist part of this.
Yeah.
No, but
there's that whole slate of great 80s kind of family oriented, but also dark and subversive sort of creature stories and all of that. And yeah, I think it's all of a piece.
And we'll be right back right after this.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always on the verge of death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone. Up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Corey Finley. So, you know, talking about these aliens, though, because when we start to find out their personality, and as you're talking about the plot, I mean, we are kind of the reality TV for them.
Yes.
But they're also sort of way attracted to this golden era TV version of America. Like, when you're making this, obviously, and again, you know, it's based on a book, but how much do you allow yourself to think about the why? Why are they like this? Why are they so attracted to power and control? Why are they so attracted to the golden era TV? You know, and why are we still in a future where the rich still get to have fun, but the rest of us don't? You know, does that sort of play a part of it as well?
Yeah, a lot of good questions there. I mean, thinking about the why, to me, it was just very, I love the idea that the aliens started, the book goes into this a little bit more, but the aliens started watching us in the 50s, which is, you know, the great human era of speculative flying saucer fiction and art and all that, right? It's kind of when those of us on Earth started looking to the stars, as you were saying earlier. And I love the idea that that was because the VOV did start watching us at that point and started catching glimpses of them here and there. And then there's, as far as the sort of colonialism metaphor, there's something interesting about, like, any culture that comes into a culture they don't totally understand. It's very easy for that sort of invading culture to sort of fix the home culture at one point in time, to sort of always see that culture. I've thought, you know, even sometimes when you'll travel around the world, you'll see the sort of touristy areas. There's people wearing the traditional garb. You get out of the touristy areas, and not every country, but like, there's certainly a kind of incentive to sell an earlier version of your culture to outsiders. And I thought that was an interesting dark twist of how the humans would be sort of economically incentivized to present themselves to the VOV.
Because getting, you know, you think at one point, like, oh, this is absurd, you know, we'd never let this happen. We would probably totally let this happen in this exact same way, and that it might be the saddest, you know, part of the story.
Definitely. And you were talking about, yeah, the rich, how would the future with this magical new technology allow an even greater wealth concentration, and, you know, a slightly left-leaning view of the past will find all sorts of times when technological innovations create a lot of profit and wealth, but that a greater and ever greater fraction of that profit is captured by, you know, the capitalists at the top. And there was something funny and dark about those capitalists at the top being, you know, not even on the surface of the earth, like the profits flowing up to the mothership.
Do you, after making something like this, after spending so much time with a story like this, you get a sense of, are we doomed as a humanity? Do we have, like, you know, that? Do you take it that far?
Sometimes. I think all of us can feel a fear about the future. Certainly some of this AI stuff is, you know, fun to play around with, but also feels, you can feel how quickly total irrelevance of human labor could become. And I guess I have a somewhat dark view of the future, but but not maybe just naively not one of total crisis yet. I think it might be coming, but all we can do is try to enjoy the world, you know, a day at a time. And as parts of the movie maybe suggest, just do your best to follow what you love and what makes you human as the world is changing.
Yeah, the AI thing, and especially with art makers, I mean, you're a maker of art, and you hear some people that are like, this is a great tool, don't be afraid of it. And you hear the other people who are on the far other end of the spectrum, you know, run for your lives. You know, where do you fall on that spectrum as a person who's, you know, able to make movies? And I'm sure to some certain degree that could make parts of it easier if it's used as a tool.
Yeah, I'm definitely more of a run for your lives person about the question of AI and in art right now. I mean, I'm not going to go and try to smash the server racks at, you know, OpenAI or anything. Like, I'm not an extremist about it, but I do think, yeah, to me, it's all a little bit chilling. I even feel like I often have debates with my more free market minded dad. Shout out to Peter Finley about technical innovations and like, did we reach a point somewhere after 1950 where sure, all the new medical innovations, for example, right, cures for strokes and, you know, cancer research and all that has clearly made human life better. And there are all these metrics that my dad can cite about how human, you know, human welfare generally is better for everyone as technologies improve. But you look at like some of the big hallmark technologies and a hallmark American technologies specifically the last several years of, you know, Uber and DoorDash and like, I don't know, I don't want to call out specific companies, but like a lot of the stuff that has increased convenience and locked us more to our phones, to me, it's not an original idea, but it's not totally clear that all of that has actually improved the quality of human life versus sort of chained us to this dark new, you know, online world evermore.
I mean, when we were younger, at least when I was younger, I remember it was, you know, we'd be told at schools like, it's not healthy to watch more than 8 hours of TV a week.
Right, right.
And now like, you can knock that out in a day or so.
Hey, the never look at your screen time apps. You know, it's always disturbing to see the number of hours you've been on your phone or laptop.
And we'll be right back right after this.
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska named three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Corey Finley.
Well, you also create a very unique alien in this movie. And I've heard you talk about it, you know, being like, it starts with a coffee table. I'd love to hear you talk about that too, because we've never seen this alien before.
I hope so. That was certainly our goal. There's so many aliens that, you know, it's there was an interesting Twitter thread by, I think it was Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about how if there was a real alien discovered, it's likely that it would be, we wouldn't even be able to conceptualize how profoundly different it would be in structure and everything else from anything we know on Earth, right? Because it would have evolved in a completely different habitat. And so obviously, you know, we didn't want to make something so abstract that it lost its groundedness. But we really tried to avoid like an octopus alien or a spider alien or a cat alien, right? Like falling into it just looks like that thing. And if anything, our North Star was, as you said, the coffee table, which is what M.T. Anderson uses to kind of describe it in the book. And then we spent a lot of time just keeping its body very, very simple and like almost comically simple, but then having its means of communication be this very elaborate like dance with these paddles being rubbed together. And so we spent a lot of time figuring out both the sound and the kind of animation elements of that. Big shout out to Eric DeBoer, who is our VFX supervisor, and to Gene Park, who spearheaded all the sound work on the creature and throughout the movie.
And their features just leaves to so many moments. I mean, watching them try to use a remote control.
Yes.
I mean, I've already done that a few times at the house, by the way, when I reach for the remote, my wife is there and just.
good.
We're adapting that into the real world is what I'm saying here.
Yes, that's me anytime I try to use a remote. Yeah.
And speaking of shout outs also to some of the cast, I mean, seeing Tiffany Haddish almost sort of play against type to what we're used to seeing her and Kylie Rogers, who, you know, I had on here talking about Beau is Afraid having her, you know, what I know that's the easy question, but what were you looking for when you cast the movie?
Yeah, I try to be very instinctive with casting. I've worked for two movies now with Ellen Lewis and Kate Sprantz, who are awesome casting teams, and they have really good instincts, and I hope I have good instincts too. And we try to like watch a lot of tape and have people read. And sometimes it's, you know, to Tiffany, it was a straight offer. We just sent her the script. She's someone I've wanted to work with since Girls Trip. I just think she's like a comic genius and has underrated dramatic chops as well. But yeah, I just think that I look for different things depending on each role. But I'd say one thing that I always am, that I'm just personally drawn to instinctively, is like actors that are very comfortable with stillness. I'm a very fidgety person. I'm not that way at all. But I think the ability to, it's a certain kind of just inner comfort and charisma. And actors that have very interesting eyes, not just physically, but that kind of use their eyes in a very specific, compelling way. I think shoot in a way that makes those qualities very important.
Well, just, you know, seeing the family dynamics of the two families at the table and just it being so at odds. I mean, everybody played their character so well in this. And I'll quickly hit, you know, of course, the music that's going on this. Jerry Wallace on the radio sounding like Elvis with those brown walls just around, set such a mood. and I wondered about that too, because, you know, we talked about sort of that golden era, but there is something that it feels like you were trying to say with that office dynamic. And what exactly was that?
Well, that's that whole idea, again, taken directly from the book, that the Veuve are kind of stuck in the 50s. They see that as a kind of human golden age. And I worked closely with Sue Chan, who's our wonderful production designer, we like this kind of weird, oppressive mid-century feeling, both for its thematic, for thematic reasons, and also it's, as you refer to, it's just such a creepy, unpleasant aesthetic, and it's so far from what we expect in a science fiction movie, of these sort of, you know, gleaming white walls and sort of beautiful, clean cinematography. We tried to sort of dirty things up as much as we could, and it was fun to have, even in these alien spaces, to zag rather than zig, and to go for a less pristine sci-fi environment. And for us, that was this kind of dated mid-century, slightly off aesthetic.
And you get Skeeter Davis doing "It's the End of the World."
Oh yeah, I love her. You really know your period music. I'm impressed.
I try to do that. Was there any, you know, you hear about people that's got songs in mind, and of course, maybe you can't clear them or whatever. Do you have those moments in movies like this? Like, oh, it's, you know, but for whatever reason?
Sometimes I'll have songs in mind, but I do think for me, like usually the music is such a late process of discovery. Certainly for my first two movies, I really did not know the direction I wanted to take the score until we had like an assembly of the movie and I could kind of feel it. With this one, I was working again with Michael Abels, who did Bad Education with me, and I think we had kind of a shorthand, and he started working on some cues before we were even finished shooting, I think, and he just started doing some crazy things with a theremin, which is such a sort of iconic and also kind of date, kind of a retro futuristic instrument, early electronic instrument, and combine that with this sort of like ramshackle orchestral feel. And that became you know, he just started kind of freestyling with it, and that became a real guiding tonal inspiration for what we were doing in the edit.
Well, as a music nerd, I love the mood of the whole thing that you were able to paint with that one too. So, Corey, Landscape with a Visible Hand is so good. August 18th, theaters?
In theaters, yes.
Looking forward to seeing it on the much bigger screen than the screen I've had so far. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it, man.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Appreciate it.
My thanks to Corey Finley. Landscape with Invisible Hand is now in theaters. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Again, I do hope you hit that subscribe button. You get 3 new interviews again every single week, a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at Spotify, Apple Podcast, at NPR, WFPK.org, and of course, YouTube for the video versions. Again, anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. After that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. You get the best in new music, lots of classic tracks. We celebrate big round of anniversaries. There are bonus interviews. One of my recent episodes included the music of Duran Duran, David Bowie, Talking Heads, Echo and the Bunnymen, Astro Gilberto, Nina Simone, Lou Reed, The Cramps, Tom Waits, Wilco, Catatonia, Billie Holiday, Suzanne Vega, Jurassic 5, The Killers, Santi Gold, Stone Roses, Fiona Apple, and an interview with Jeff Ament from Pearl Jam. That's just an example of what you get every weeknight at 6 p.m. At WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots anywhere there's social media. My address is at Kyle Meredith. So I do hope you like and follow along. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith, and I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.